good news is you can QSY real fast and you don't have to do any tuning. The bad news is they can't tolerate any substantial amount of standing wave ratio. I, for one, have used a 20-meter dipole, which has a 20-to-1 standing wave ratio, and I made some great DX contacts on it. And so, with the right kind of a transmitter, no sweat. So, power is being reflected. The nasty thing about the way transmission lines work is that when the transmission line is really humming, and you treat it correctly, if it's 50-ohm line, and you've got a transmitter that likes looking into a 50-ohm load, and it's a 50-ohm transmission line, and the far end of the 50-ohm transmission line sees a 50-ohm resistive load, the power flows in one direction and none of it comes back, and as far as the antenna is concerned, it thinks the transmitter is a micro-miniature thing mounted at the end of that transmission line. A transmission line, if it's a low-loss one, properly used, it electronically moves your transmitter from the shack to the top of the tower, so to speak. That's what it really does. That's the good news. The bad news is that the nasty characteristic of most coaxial and twin lead type transmission lines, and many other transmission lines, is that they have this magic characteristic called characteristic impedance, which means that you will create exactly that load, and no other load, if it's a 50-ohm line or a 52-ohm transmission line, you will load it with 52 ohms if you want 100% of its capability. And anything else, the crazy characteristic of the transmission line is that it doesn't launch all of the signal into the antenna. It allows some of it to flow back. Well, of the power that flows back, it must still obey conservation of energy. Your solid-state transmitter has transistors in it that are running in almost the perfect constant current mode. So does your tetrode tube. Triode tube, I'll admit, is a little bit more complicated. But a tetrode tube or most solid-state transistors are almost a perfect constant current generator. Let me drop. That means a constant current generator means it has a equivalent resistor in series with that source of your 100 watts, which acts like it's almost infinity, an extremely high number of ohms. That's what a constant current generator is. If you measured its impedance in ohms, it would be some huge number, like 10,000 ohms. So you've got a 50-ohm transmission line, you've got an antenna that's got a slight mismatch, a 2-to-1, it's reflecting more than 10% of the power, that comes back to the transmitter. The transmitter is almost a perfect open circuit. It cannot accept that power. The power gets re-reflected forward. 99% of the time, Murphy's Law will be such that the power that gets re-reflected forward, that was reflected back to the transmitter and the transmitter didn't accept it, most of the time, it's not going to be in your favor. It's going to be out of phase. The magic of an antenna tuner is that it takes the crazy impedance of your antenna plus feed line. And let me give you a couple of words on that one. Mel has already told us by way of the mini lectures he's given on the Smith chart. And if you go to the website where all of this jazz is continuously being recorded, which is amateurradio.tv, www.amateurradio.tv, and you click on the line there that says Smith chart, you'll be able to go back to the mini lectures that were recorded a year or so ago, given by Mel. And what that mini lecture on the Smith chart was telling you is that if I've got an antenna, and I'm just going to pick a number out of the air, it's a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. My particular antenna presents a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio by acting like 25 ohms. I've got a 50-ohm transmission line, and my antenna is acting like 25 ohms. It's a 2-to-1 error in impedance, therefore it does create a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. And by the way, there's an infinite number of ways of making a 2.0 standing wave ratio. I can also do it with a 100-ohm load. I can do it with a 50-ohm load and just the right amount of reactance. There's a circle around the Smith chart at the so-called 2-to-1 standing wave ratio radius. In other words, you go to the bottom of the chart and you set up your calipers to be the length of 2-to-1, which maybe is 1 inch. And you take your compass and you swing a circle on the Smith chart of 1 inch, if that was the right number. And everything along that line on the Smith chart, every one of those possible impedances is a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. So there's an infinite number of them. I chose the particular one called 25 ohms. So I put 25 ohms for my particular antenna. And if my feed line was zero in length or some number of multiples of a half wavelength of transmission line, one half wavelength, three half wavelengths, two half wavelengths, five half wavelengths, some number of half wavelengths. The magic of a transmission line is that the impedance repeats every half wavelength. So I've got some number of half wavelengths of my transmission line in this particular example, and I look into that transmission line, I will see 25 ohms. If I have an odd number of quarter wavelengths, I'll see 100 ohms. That's called impedance inversion. I've got a 25 ohm antenna. If I've got a quarter wave, three-quarter wave, five-quarter wave of transmission line, looking into the transmission line, I won't see the 50, or 25, I'll see 100. But it's 2 or 2 to 1. I'm not changing the magnitude of the standing wave ratio. I'm just changing...
Repeater, time out.
I'm not changing the magnitude of the standing wave ratio. I'm just changing the way it looks in the shack by doing nothing but changing the length of transmission line. Of course, this sounds crazy the first time you hear it. Ain't easy to explain what in the world is going on. You could say God designed transmission lines that way. You could also say Maxwell's equation told you what's happening. This guy Maxwell, way back in 1850, invented the mathematics that explains this. There's lots of ways of looking at it. Ain't easy. But transmission lines will give you a different impedance in the shack depending on their length, even though you didn't change the antenna. The magic of an antenna tuner is that if it's well designed, it'll take a 25 ohm load that you see in the shack and make it look like 50 as far as the transmission is concerned, transmitter is concerned. Or it will take the 100 ohms, if you've got an odd number of quarter wavelengths of line, in my example, and you see 100 ohms in the shack, it'll take the 100 ohms and make it look like 50. It's a different adjustment, but when that antenna tuner is doing that impedance conversion internally, it's doing an impedance match. It is making your crazy impedance at your end of the transmission line look like a 50 ohm resistor to the transmitter, and the transmitter is happy. At first you'd say, okay, I had 10% of the power being reflected, where did it go? If I gave this exact same puzzle to the guys on the 20 meter band on a Saturday afternoon, I'd have a bunch of people jumping on me and Mel saying that you guys are crazy. That power, it disappears. The 10% power reflected gets absorbed by the antenna tuner. Well, if that's true, then the antenna tuner must be getting hot. A well-designed antenna tuner runs ice cold. The transmitter is happy, it sees 50 ohms. The crazy 25 ohm antenna is happy, it's seeing all of the power that you're able to generate, the whole 100 watts. And the antenna tuner is running ice cold. What did the antenna tuner do? Yes, it did an impedance match. It is kind of like a filter. You can design a filter where the input impedance is 50 ohms and the output impedance is 25 ohms and the filter is tuned to 3975, a bandpass filter. You can design a filter where the input impedance and the output impedance is anything you want and it's a passband at your favorite frequency, 3975. You could say your antenna tuner is become repeater.
Time out.
You could say your antenna tuner, when it finally settles down to its proper adjustment, it has been simultaneously acting like a band pass filter, that's good, with a characteristic impedance of 50 ohms in and 25 ohms out, that's good. At first you'd say, gee, it's doing everything. How does it do that? You get into the nitty-gritty of what's going on inside of the antenna tuner. You'll suddenly realize that you think you were adjusting the equivalent of a tuning and loading control. It's like a Pi network in many cases. It's got a tuning and loading control, maybe a variable capacitor, but it's making those adjustments automatically so that the impedance is matched, the frequency of design, passband is exactly where you want it, and you would say, gee, it's doing a good impedance match. What happened to the reflective power? You didn't realize that when you were adjusting, or when it was adjusting those controls, it was not only setting the right center frequency, it was not only setting the right input and output impedance, it was also doing something else at the same time. And you can't avoid that. When you have a properly tuned filter, bandpass filter, that passes your favorite frequency and gives you the right impedance matches, it does something else automatically that you didn't know about. And that is, every bit of that reflected power hits that lossless filter. The filter consists of nothing but inductors and capacitors. If it's well designed, there is no resistor per se inside of that antenna tuner. There is no resistor there. It's only got inductors and capacitors. You cannot continuously absorb power into a pure inductor. You cannot continuously absorb power into a pure capacitor. They will not absorb it. The transmitter is almost an open circuit. It will not absorb it. Therefore, when you did that adjustment, you didn't know it, but it automatically was adjusting itself such that all of the power reflected from the antenna hits the antenna tuner, gets re-reflected forward. Not only every bit of it is re-reflected forward, but it's re-reflected forward exactly in phase with the power the transmitter is now generating. Ain't that magic? It re-reflects the power forward exactly in phase with the power the transmitter is now generating. If you put a well-calibrated repeater,
time out.
If you put a well-calibrated bird watt meter in that line, assuming their feed line is low and lost, you put it in between the antenna tuner and your antenna, you put it in that line anywhere you like, you measure the forward power and you measure the reverse power, you'll see something crazy. You know the transmitter into a dummy load makes exactly 100 watts. You know that the transmitter is seeing exactly 50 ohms. Therefore, if you put the bird watt meter between the transmitter and the antenna tuner, you'll see 100 watts going forward and 0 watts going back. And you know the antenna tuner is not absorbing any of that. It runs ice cold. You now put the bird watt meter after the antenna tuner in the transmission line going to the antenna. You'll see something like 120 watts going forward and something like 13 watts coming back. You'll say, what in the world is going on? How can there be 120 watts going forward when my transmitter only puts out 100 watts? And I know that at the antenna itself, 10% of the power that gets there is being reflected. In the process of that antenna tuner re-reflecting the voltage forward, I said power up till now. Mother Nature doesn't think in power, she thinks in volts. It re-reflects the voltage of the reflected power forward and adds it to the voltage the transmitter is now generating. The forward power on that transmission line will be something like 120 watts. And the reflected power will be something like 12 watts, 10% of it. So Mother Nature has added the voltage together. The antenna will be radiating 99.9 watts. Because he doesn't radiate every bit of it that he gets, because some of it he's always continuously reflecting. But that antenna tuner automatically adjusts those phases to do that. I can't find any single book on the explanation of an antenna tuner or filter theory that puts it into those words. What you're hearing is a strongly felt philosophy based on a bunch of measurements and a bunch of talk with a bunch of smart people who know filter design, and they've confirmed what I'm saying. I give you a 90-some-odd% chance that what I'm saying is accurate. Wouldn't stake my life on it. But it is a philosophy that works. It fits the measurements that you can make as long as you've got a well-tuned bird watt meter that doesn't have an error in its repeater.
Time out.
It doesn't have a slug in its antenna, an error in its slug, as long as it's got high directivity. You add the fact that many guys have got a Vizsla meter that doesn't have high directivity. In the forward mode, it's supposed to measure nothing but the power flowing forward on the transmission line. In the reverse mode, the same thing, only the reverse power. If there's a lack of directivity, improper adjustment, or a damage that has occurred to your particular directional power measuring device, maybe it's a bird watt meter, maybe it's a directional coupler, maybe it's a Vizsla meter, if it is not well calibrated, so that in the forward mode, it is also slightly responding to reverse power. And in the reverse mode, it's slightly responding to forward power. In that condition, you move the bird watt meter or Vizsla watt meter downrange in the feed line or closer to the transmitter, and all the readings will change, forward power and reverse power. When you see that, you know something's wrong. In the real world, once you have set up a particular antenna, a particular transmitter, a particular feed line, no matter where along that line, except for the insertion loss, no matter where along that line you make the measurement, you should see approximately the same forward and reverse power, as long as your feed line is low and lost. If your feed line's got a whole lot of loss, then the reverse power is being attenuated by the time it comes back to the shack, and you see a lower number. But you can recalibrate that. If you know what kind of feed line you're using, and you look it up in the chart, and you know what the insertion loss is in decibels, you can recalibrate what you see as reflected power, and you know what the real reflected power is. So that's a no-brainer in some people's minds. I know this is a lot more words than you expected to get, Joe, and I know that not all of this is going to make sense the first time you hear it. It's a subject that it bears repeating. If you come back next week and ask the question slightly differently, and I answer the question again slightly differently, there's nothing wrong with that. Everything I told you is highly misunderstood by the vast majority of engineers with four-year college degrees and above. So the H-U-R-Y-Y, H-U-R-I-W in the text net.
Well, I always like the complicated explanation because that way I can sort through what I can understand and what I can't understand, or maybe have a little difficulty understanding it. But that seems to make a little bit more sense now. So I do thank you for the explanation. Not that I have an antenna to use, but it was just sort of a curiosity type of question. And because you know what made me kind of curious is because I've used the antenna on going from one band to another, and you said you use yours on, I guess, another band where you've had like a 20-to-1 VSWR. Well, I don't want to get on 40 meters, for example, but I can talk to a station that's not more than 25 miles away from me, and they come booming in on 80 meters with the power level he runs. I mean, you know, 40 over S9 type of reading. No problem hearing at all. On 80 meters. It goes to 40 meters or 20 meters with the same antenna. The signal reception is terrible. Now, he has a resonant antenna on all these bands. I know the problem is pretty much on my end, how I'm receiving and partially a propagation issue. That's why he asked about the antenna tuner question. So I guess the antenna is also, if it's way out of band, it's also not very efficient on these other frequencies, and the antenna tuner can or cannot really compensate for that, can it?
That's part of it, Joe. When you go from 80 to 40 meters, and you're using antennas that are a small number of wavelengths above the ground, near vertical incident sky wave type stuff, NIRS antennas, and in the case of 80 meters, you might be doing it at high noon where you got a lot of D-layer absorption. There's a lot of variables involved. However, every one of the antennas you and I use, with the rare exception of rhombic and beverage, antennas that are a zillion wavelengths long, with that rare exception, every one of them is a standing wave structure. Fancy way of saying the power has to bounce back and forth in that antenna a large number of times before it's radiated. That's the reason why you resonate the antenna system first, then you can radiate. And you're radiating the antenna system. That means antenna, feed line, antenna tuner, transmitter. That total system must hit resonance at the frequency you want to transmit if you want to transmit more than a fraction of a percent of the power you've got available to you. Once you've got that system resonated, and even if the antenna has got a 20-to-1 VSWR, if the feed line is low enough and lost, and the power is bouncing back and forth between your antenna and the antenna tuner on that transmission line, the power itself is bouncing back and forth 20 times before it gets radiated. If the feed line is low enough and lost, that's not a big problem. And 90-some-odd% of the power will be radiated, even though it is a 40-meter antenna being used on 80 meters. As you make your dipole smaller and smaller, and you take a 40-meter dipole and you use it on 80 meters, it's one half the size it should be. At first you would say, wow, it's going to be, let me drop, half the size it should be, and because it's an area relationship, you would say, gee, I'm going to be 6 dB down. Uh-oh. A infinitesimal dipole that is being resonated can still run near 100% efficiency if you're smart enough to make it out of low-loss material. I'll admit the antenna will have an extremely high Q. It'll have a whole lot of energy bouncing back and forth. It'll be narrow band as all hell. That's what high Q means. You tune the antenna to 3805, and you want to use it at 3815, and it's already climbed up to a 1.8 standing wave ratio. That's what a very narrow band antenna will do. The QSY just a little bit, and you got to do a whole lot of retuning of everything. But once you do that retuning, where the feed line is low enough and lost, an antenna that is the wrong size, particularly too small, can still radiate 98% of your power, so to speak. That concept, the infinitesimal dipole, there's a whole chapter in the book by Krauss called Antennas, McGraw-Hill, 1950, on that exact subject, the infinitesimal dipole. It gives an awful lot of people a lot of trouble. How in the world can it have the same gain? And it loses half a dB of gain, maximum, as you go from a full-size half-wave dipole in free space down to an infinitesimal dipole, you lose half a dB in apparent measured gain, because the pattern gets a little bit broader. The dipole pattern becomes a little bit broader, and it's not real loss of power. It's just that the broadside power goes down a little bit because the power off the ends goes up a little bit. You're still radiating all of it into space. Because the gain is there within a half a dB, the 2.15 dB for a dipole, let me drop, 2.15 dB over isotropic becomes 1.76 or something like that, half a dB down, 1.66. Anyhow, half a dB less apparent gain broadside, because the gain is still there, and gain equals area, the area is still there. So the first question you would ask yourself is, how the hell can an infinitesimal dipole, something I can just barely see, how come it's still got all of that area? In the case of an 80-meter halfway dipole, the electronic area of that antenna is 8,500 square feet. Now, I'm not kidding. It's really there. If your eyes operated at that frequency, you would see a great big black oval around that dipole that has 8,500 square feet of area to it. And every signal coming into that direction with that polarity on that frequency enters that big black elliptical area, 8,500 square feet, gets sucked up into the wire of that dipole, goes down the feed line, and moves your resmeter on the receiver. That's the real area of a dipole. And if I make that halfway dipole on 80 meters that used to be 132 feet long, and I decide to make it 32 feet long instead and re-resonate it, it comes up with almost the exact same area, 8,500 square feet. How the hell, it'll go down to 8,000 square feet, half a dB less. How in the world does it do that? And that's the magic of resonance. The signal is now bouncing back and forth in that antenna a large number of times. That's what high Q means, a lot more stored energy versus dissipated energy when you transmit it. It's got a huge amount of stored energy. It's making large amounts of voltage and current on the center of that dipole. That in turn generates these great big magnetic and electrostatic fields around the antenna, and it reestablishes that effective capture area on transmit and receive. That's the magic of resonance. You will resonate that antenna radiating system first, then it will radiate. Magic words. You will not find those words in any respected antenna book. I'd love to know why. You'll find all kinds of fancy formulas that when you dig deep enough, it is saying that, but the words are not there. You're catching on to some of the reason why antenna knowledge is such a rare art. You almost have to make a Faustian Bach repeater.
Time out.
There are people who think you have to make a Faustian bargain. You have to make a bargain with the devil in order to get the knowledge of how an antenna works. Well, in reality, it just takes an apprenticeship. It takes years of experience. You want a real good antenna engineer, you hire a ham radio operator who has been doing some real tinkering in his backyard. He knows really how antennas work. The high-flung theory and fancy equations that are in the book does not basically tell you how to build an antenna. It takes experience of really doing it, and you find out what works and what doesn't work, and you start digging into the particulars, and you find out you're resonating it. That's the first thing you do with any antenna. In order to properly resonate it, in order to really couple the power into it, you've probably also done some impedance matching. And you probably have a feed line in there somewhere, a transmission line. And you've made sure that you're treating the transmission line correctly. The right load impedance if possible, or the right antenna tuner, and so on. So, as we discuss antennas more and more over the years, more and more of this ham radio-derived knowledge, from my point of view, will be conveyed among ourselves, and more of us can become antenna engineers. When you've got that skill, let me drop. If you have real experience at building antennas and properly impedance matching them, designing them, making them work at the right frequency range, packing them into small packages, getting the right polarity, the right antenna pattern, the right bandwidth of operation, if you've got that skill, people will beat past to your door. In my case, they have. I've run a consulting business now for 9 years, and the majority of what I do is antenna design. I have to turn down work. I've got this website that describes what I can do, and there are people coming to me at times when I can't handle the work and I've got to turn it down. I'm a member of the IEEE Long Island Consultants Network. It's a network of 40 other IEEE engineers. We meet at Briarcliff College on the first Wednesday of every single month at 6:30 in the evening. We get together and we compare notes as to what the world of consulting is like. Of those 40 engineers, three of them have got real RF knowledge. Most of them are computer scientists. The three RF knowledgeable people are continuously getting work. The others are continuously looking for work. They're always sending out advertisements. They're always calling on the telephone. They're using all their friendships. They're continuously working at finding work. Whereas the RF savvy people, most of the time, have to turn down work that they can't handle. It is such a rare art. It is so poorly taught in the schools that if you've got that skill, people will be passed to your door. That's my point of view. And now your son says, "Gee, I think I really like ham radio, and I want to become an RF engineer." Don't turn him down. Don't discourage him. The hard part is to find the school that's going to teach him the art. The school gave me the degree by which I can call myself an engineer. But that's not where the majority of the knowledge I use on a day-to-day basis is coming from. 80-some-odd percent, maybe more, of the knowledge I use that puts bread on my table came from ham radio experience. From H2RYY. When your son wants to become an engineer, what are you going to tell him, Joe? H2RYW is the tech net.
That would be an impossible thing to have happen because I don't have a son. So I don't have to worry about that. Okay, you've run this one out pretty good as far as the antenna tuner thing. I guess part of the thing would be the dipole working out of bands is, a little bit of a mystery to me as far as its efficiency, because the radio I'm using has an antenna tuner within the radio, and even though I can resonate the antenna on different bands, I can get to resonate in some parts of 40 meters okay, some parts of 20 meters okay. It doesn't seem like it really has the efficiency there. The transceiver thinks it's putting out okay, but as far as what I hear compared to like another antenna, for example, like going like 20 meter vertical, and talk to this particular station about 20 miles away, it comes much better on the vertical than the horizontal dipole, which is actually resonant about 80 meters, 30, 30.05, something like that. I think it's what she said, actually said for. And it has a 1-to-1 battle on it, too, so maybe that's part of the problem, too. But anyway, okay. Hey, one other question. This is a simple one. I think I've asked this one before. I just want to get a repeat on the answer. On the DTV frequency of that carrier that's below, that's just above the bottom edge of the band, I know it's 0.3094. I want to write the rest of it down just so I have it made in my notations here. That probably sounds like a KE2EJ question, right?
Another question, Dick.
KC2QIQ with a comment.
Okay, we've got Alex and Glenn in that order recognized, and yes, Eric is the only guy that can really give us all the decimal places of the 0.3094 or whatever his megacycle offset for the so-called reference frequency within the digital television transmitting signal across the 6 meg bandwidth. Let's see if Eric is there. KE2EJ, we hope you're there. If not, we're waiting for you. K2RIW in the deck, man. We're going to have to wait till Eric comes back. And I've got some digital television news to tell you guys also. I've made some changes in my system. But Alex and Greg in that order. Alex, M2MNU, go right ahead.
I have a question about my tuner. I have an old MSJ Versa tuner here. And it melted the inductor, the roller inductor. What created the heat into that roller inductor, Dick, and to an Eric?
Okay. If you are going into an extremely high standing wave ratio load, like a 1-ohm resistor or a 1,000-ohm resistor, or a highly capacitive load, if there is a high standing wave ratio in the load, the only way the antenna tuner can match into that is to also present the complementary very high standing wave ratio. That's a fancy way of saying there's going to be a lot of energy bouncing back and forth. High currents are going to occur somewhere in the system. The worst case situation would be if the antenna tuner attempts to match an open circuit because you forgot to connect the antenna. That's one possible way it could happen. And it attempts to match that situation. you'll develop extremely high circulating current within the inductors and capacitors of the antenna tuner. To my knowledge, that's the only way you can burn up an inductor, put too darn much inductance, too darn much current through it. And the way the current can go through there that gets very high is because you're supplying a continuous amount of power from the transmitter, like 100 watts, and if the Q of the network, because you've got a high standing wave ratio load, happens to be 1,000, a Q of 1,000, the word Q, has about four or five definitions. One of the definitions is energy stored per cycle versus energy dissipated per cycle. One of the definitions is the center frequency divided by the bandwidth of the network. Another one is voltage rise at resonance or current rise at resonance. In other words, if the network is acting as a pi network with an ordinary tuning into a 50 ohm load and ordinarily has 1 ampere flowing through the inductor, but you make some kind of a change and readjust it so that now it has a Q of 1,000 where it used to have a Q of 100, then the 1 ampere it used to have will change by that ratio, a 10 versus 1,000, which is a 100-to-1 increase. So the 1 ampere you used to have becomes 100 amperes flowing through the inductor. Now, the inductor itself, in some cases, there's a switch. Let me drop. In some cases, there's a range switch with a bunch of taps on the inductor, and the range switch also has to carry that high current, and the poor little contacts may be rated for 5 amperes, and maybe you're putting a 100 amperes through them, and they're going to burn up. Or the inductor itself, if you insist that it run into such extremely high standing wave ratios, then you may have to build the inductor out of copper tubing instead of a 14-gauge wire, if you know what I mean. And in the case of the old-fashioned ARC-5, which had a roller inductor, now you had a real silver-plated sliding contact that picks up the turns of the coil of that inductor. And as long as everything is brand new and shiny and silver-plated, and you're putting normal current through it, no sweat. You take that ARC-5 transmitter built in World War II, where all of that silver plating has been worn away years ago, and you're misusing it today, and you try to put 100 amperes through that sliding contact, they're going to burn it up. So these are some guesses as to what could have happened. It's a kind of conservation of energy. The only way you can get the energy out of the tuning network called antenna tuner is that you must create the conjugate impedance match between it and whatever your load is. And if your load happens to be a very high VISWR, that becomes a very difficult thing to do, and the circulating current in the network can start climbing sky high. N2NNU, K2LIW in the tech net.
Then get up back to me, Dick.
And, okay, we'll go to you right after Alex. Alex first, go ahead.
Okay, first of all, the matching is supposed to be done to a 1 to a 7. The antenna presented a 7 mismatch. So, following that, the statement that SWR does not create heat, it's misleading. Is that correct?
It sure is. When I say that an antenna tuner dissipates no power, I will admit to you I'm speaking in the ideal world. If I design a very good antenna tuner with great big diameter of the inductor, I maybe made it out of quarter-inch diameter copper tubing, and I use great big air variable capacitors so that now the series equivalent resistance of that coil is a micro-ohm, and the series equivalent resistance of that variable capacitor, the great big air variable capacitor, is another micro-ohm. If I use that as an antenna tuner, I will never, under any reasonable conditions, get any heat out of that antenna tuner. It'll always run ice cold. Now I enter the real world of commercial manufacturing, which I've now got to take that great big coil, that great big air variable capacitor, and I got to squeeze it into a small package, and I've got to make it inexpensive so that I can manufacture this thing, sell it at a price that you're willing to pay for, and I can make a profit. Once I start adding the real constraints of the real world of squeezing it down to small size and making it cheap, and now I use an inductor that's not that good, and it's got some serious resistance to it, and I use a miniaturized air variable capacitor that's not that good, and it's got some series resistance to it, and it's rated for up to a 7-to-1 standing wave ratio, worst case. Or maybe it's a 7-to-1. information, and if the manufacturer tells the truth, I'd like to believe the amount of heat dissipated in that new, more compact coil can be tolerated. And now you put a, if it's rated for 100 watts and you put 150 watts into it, and it's rated for 7-to-1 standing wave ratio maximum, and you put it into a 10-to-1 standing wave ratio, if I push my luck, I can easily burn up that commercially available thing made by MFJ. Assuming they're telling the truth. If they're telling the truth, I'm misusing it. And if I'm not misusing it, then they're not telling the truth. But you're going to get heat with the one you can buy. But once a guy like Mel builds an antenna tuner, and right after I give it back to you for a quickie, and then Mel's going to tell us what he built for an antenna tuner, you're going to find out he made one that really runs ice cold. That's the good news. But if he had to go into a manufacturing company and build that and sell it at a reasonable price, life would get a little more difficult. N2NNU for any comment. K2LAW
repeater. Time out.
You got it, Alex.
Yeah, okay, Dick. I had several confrontations with hams that were suggesting that the antenna tuners do not heat up because no power is dissipating in that. So, at least now we have a confirmation from the gurus of antennas. Okay, Dick. Just wanted to clarify that in my mind. Dick?
Yeah, the gurus of antennas are ham radio operators. Rich, we're going to get to you in a second. Mel is next. Mel, tell us about the size of the components you use on that antenna tuner of yours, which is truly lossless, but how difficult I think it would be to manufacture those, sell them to ham radio operators, and still make a profit. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Okay, this is K2KEY. I observed that years ago, that the rotary inductors that they were using in the commercial manufactured of, you know, number of companies that make tuners for ham radio, that those rotary inductors used to get very hot, and some of them actually will be smoking. And so I went ahead and I re-engineered one. I made my own rotary inductor, actually, and the wheel that I have on it, I noticed, in fact, the one I had that was making a little spark, I'd look in there in the dark, I can see sparks, and sometimes I just would wiggle the main tuning knob on the rotary inductor, and I get it to a point where it wouldn't spark, but just wiggling it a little bit, and I said, what the heck is going on here? And it's because it just wasn't making tight enough contact, and so that's why it was getting hot. So when I went and built this tuner, I built the tuner to match the Collins S line, actually. I got a cabinet, I got the S line meter, knobs, the whole business, the paneling, everything. And I used two vacuum capacitors in it, and I used my home built rotary inductor because I couldn't find one the way I wanted it. The ones that Collins originally used were very good, but no longer available, of course. And so I went ahead and I built one. And what I did is I beefed up that system with the wheel. I made a wider wheel, number one, and number two, a deeper groove so it rides deeper into the coil. And also, the arm that goes across, I used a brass rod going across, not a little skinny rod like they have a 1/8 rod or whatever they have in there, something 1/16 or 1/8. I used a 1/4 inch rod, and it's threaded. So that what happens is this thing is actually... Now, and like you've seen in many pieces of professional equipment like Collins did, where it actually is a threaded track going across a dick rather than just a slide. And I put a lot of money, yes I did, into that tuner, buying a lot of things, a lot of work, but it's so far never given me a day's trouble. Go ahead.
Oh, you did it right. Wow. It would be difficult to sell that at a profit, but that's the right way to do it. If you really want your antenna tuner to give you top-notch performance, there are ways that we amateurs, with simple equipment, can measure the equivalent series resistance of the roller inductor, of the variable capacitor, and whatever. And what you're looking for here is milliohms. An ordinary grunt inductor, wound any old way, can easily have multiple ohms of series resistance. If you want it to be a good inductor for an antenna tuner, where you want high efficiency, you're looking for a milliohm of series resistance on the inductor and a milliohm of series resistance on the capacitor. You do that, and you're going to have an antenna tuner that runs 99.9% efficiency, even if you're matching a 10-to-1 standing wave ratio and you're doing it at 500 watts of power. So it's a matter of the right materials, and like everything else in life, there's a compromise. You have to get what you pay for. If you insist on it being inexpensive and packed into a small package, you're going to get mediocre performance unless you find some kind of a breakthrough. Doing it right requires sweat and toil and size and quality and dollars. But the guy who can avoid all that is Rich. I think Rich wanted to make a comment on this before we go over to Glenn's comment. Rich, did you say you wanted to say something on this? N2EO, K2LIW?
Dick. What I wanted to say is, what you say is true, an inductor and a capacitor dissipate no power. What Alex is saying about the tuner dissipating power, it's the fact that the there's ohmic loss, DC resistance, I squared R losses in those coils and capacitors. Am I correct? And the other thing I wanted to say, when you were talking about resonance and adjusting the tuner, could we say that a tuner is nothing more than a phase shift network?
No. A phase shift network phenomena of a tuner is a necessary but not sufficient. The main thing the antenna tuner is doing is, if it's got quality components, it is making a near-perfect impedance match between the transmitter and whatever your load is. Your load can be any old thing that makes a 7-to-1, a 10-to-1 standing wave ratio, and maybe it's a 10-ohm load resistor, and you've got a 50-ohm rated transmitter where it performs properly when loaded with 50 ohms. And that 5-to-1 impedance ratio can be done by the antenna tuner. And when that antenna tuner is properly aligned as a bandpass filter with that impedance ratio, it then automatically is acting as exactly the right phase shift of reflection. So normally when people talk about phase shift of a network, they're talking about input-output phase shift. That's not what I'm talking about here. I'm talking about the exact phase shift of what's called S22 on scattering parameters measured by a network analyzer. I'll explain what that is. If I've got a black box, maybe it's an amplifier. It's got an input connector and it's got an output connector. When I'm measuring the standing wave ratio characteristics of the input connector, a network analyzer calls that S11. 1-1 means my power is going into port number 1, and I'm measuring what's reflecting back out of port number 1. That's why there's a 1-1 there. S22 means I'm applying power to the output connector, port number 2, and I'm measuring how much reflects off of that output connector, number 2. That's why it's called S22. So what the antenna tuner is doing is it's adjusting itself for exactly the right phase shift of S22. Not transfer characteristics, reflection characteristics phase of the output connector of the antenna tuner. It happens to be doing that automatically. So to simply call it a phase shifter, as you can see, there's a lot more going on in there. And lucky for us, it happens automatically, and the average guy doesn't know that this is happening. Glenn's got some comments and questions about all the gov. KC2QIQ. Hey, straighten this all out, Glenn. I've made it complicated. K2RIW.
Repeater. Time out.
I don't know, Dick. I think you've got it right on the money. But my comment goes back a couple of steps here. My comment is about Joe's performance of his 80-meter antenna and 40-meter antenna. I think I have a solution for that one, if you're interested.
Fire away.
Okay, this is something I've run across with wire antennas in the past, where I have an 80-meter dipole, and I can set up as an inverted V or just a regular, you know, flat-top type of dipole up there and tune it within my feed line and have a nice perfect match, operate on 80 meters and the signals are 20-40 over, everybody's beautiful. Then I take my antenna tuner, retune it inside the shack with the antenna tuner, and retune it for 40 meters. Now all of a sudden, I'm not getting the performance that I would expect in the kind of propagation of 40 that I was getting on 80. And after a little bit of research, what I found out was happening was that now I'm not just radiating this 80-meter antenna, I'm also radiating the feed line. And what was happening was the position that I had the feed line in was affecting the takeoff angle of my antenna, and it wasn't propagating the same way as the 80-meter antenna, and it was basically giving me an odd propagation pattern. What I found, when I tried moving the feed line around, that helped it a little bit. The cure to fix this problem was to take a 40-meter antenna and build a second dipole right underneath the 80-meter dipole, just as a second antenna that would give me a match right at the end of the feed line for 40 meters, and then I could just use the tuner to just do a slight trim up on the other end, and then that fixes the problem. KC2QIQ.
That's a good solution, but let me ask you this one, Glenn. Could you have made it a fan dipole, where an 80-meter dipole and a 40-meter dipole with a little bit of separation, angular separation between them, came to the exact same feed point, assuming you've got a good enough broadband balance at that point? Wouldn't that also have been a single feed line solution to give you what you want? Back to you, Glenn.
You explained it a lot better, Dick, but that's exactly what I did. So I might not have put it in the correct wording. But basically, taking that same 80-meter antenna and fan a second 40-meter right underneath it, and that cures the whole problem right there. Using the same feed line, and you have good propagation angle. Otherwise, what will happen is the whole system is resonant with the antenna tuner. It's just that, unfortunately, sometimes the feed line will give you a not necessarily great propagation pattern. It could upset the propagation pattern enough where the antenna might not be all that usable, depending on the length of the feed line, how it's running along the side of the house, etc.
M2EO. Rich recognized. What you've got there is a good solution, Glenn. And let me give you a couple of words as to why a fan dipole works so well. For people who refuse to build a fan dipole because they think it's too quick and dirty, there's a dipole for each one of the bands I care about in that fan, but how do I know it's really going to do what I want? Let's just talk about an 80 and 40 meter dipole. One of them is roughly 132 feet long, and one of them is roughly 67 feet long, and I bring them together at a common point where I'm feeding the two. And I got a slight fan angle between them so that the ends of the wires are not too close together, capacitive coupling. When I'm on 80 meters, the 80-meter dipole presents a 70-ohm impedance. The 40-meter dipole presents a capacitive reactance of probably 1,000 ohms. When that power is flowing down the transmission line, it sees a beautiful 70-ohm resistor, that's called 80-meter dipole, and 99% of the power is going to go there. As far as the power coming down that transmission line is concerned, that other thing called 40-meter dipole, which is 1,000 ohms of capacitive reactance, is almost an open circuit, and essentially none of the power goes down there. You could force the power to go down the 40-meter dipole if the 80 wasn't present, the 80-meter dipole wasn't present, and you got a real broad-range antenna tuner to rematch that. Conversely, when you're on 40 meters coming out of your transmitter, the 40-meter dipole is presenting a nice 70-ohm load. The 80-meter dipole is now being fed to higher frequency. It's now presenting an inductive load of a couple thousand ohms. And again, the power flows in the right direction. So the antenna that you care about for that particular frequency presents the good load. The other antenna is so reactive, it's almost an open circuit, inductive or capacitive, and therefore doesn't accept the power. So it becomes an automatic electronic switch. It's very subtle what a fan dipole is. It's an automatic electronic switch that, as long as you've got the right frequency relationship between your multiple dipoles that are being fanned out, the power will only flow down the desired dipole, and less than 1% of it will flow down the wrong one. And that little bit of power that does flow down the wrong one doesn't hurt you. It's in the right direction, if you know what I mean. So it's a very subtle, very high-performance antenna. You get a lot for your money out of a fan dipole.
Repeater, time out.
N2EO to take it. Doug to take it after Rich first. N2EO, go ahead, Rich, K2LIW.
Okay, Dick, what you said is very true, but there's actually a better way. For instance, if you take an 80, to prove a point, if you take an 80-meter dipole fed with coax, that's the key word, coax, try iron running on 20 meters, 40 meters, or 10 meters, you're going to get miserable results. What I found is coax, even at low frequencies, when it's terribly mismatched, the losses go sky high. You'll be amazed if you take an 80-meter dipole, feed it with open wire line. Open wire line is almost worthless, even with a high vis flap. It'll work every man with a tuner from 80 meters right up to 10 meters. Or basically what you want to do is cut the antenna for a half wave or as close to a half wave as you can get to the lowest frequency you want to use. And everything above that will just fall into place. It works wonderfully. I've been using it here for 5 or 6 years, Dick, and it's the best way to go.
Yeah, I know that Barry N2EO and Rich N2EO and Barry N2MB and others have experimented with feeding dipoles on the wrong frequency. And whenever they did it with coax, they had rather poor results. When they did it with open wire line, they had rather good results. And there's at least two reasons for this. Number one, the open wire line, properly used, has a lot lower loss. So it can tolerate a high standing wave ratio where the power is reflecting back and forth between the antenna and the antenna tuner and finally getting radiated. So that power is bouncing back and forth in your transmission line if you've got a high vis wire. And then the open wire line handles that situation a lot better because of the lower loss. That's number one. Number two, when I feed a dipole with coax cable and it's on the wrong frequency, by definition, the antenna is highly reactive. If I'm high in frequency, the antenna is too inductive. If I'm low in frequency compared to the center frequency of the dipole, it's highly capacitive, but it's highly reactive. And the only way you can feed a highly reactive antenna with a properly operating antenna tuner is that at the antenna terminals, you're developing an extremely high voltage, a resonant high voltage to overcome that high reactive, so you can still pour power into that antenna. When you have the combination of an unbalanced transmission line, which means that half of the voltage you put on the dipole is ending up on the outside of the coax cable, and therefore the coax cable becomes part of the radiator, and you combine that with a highly reactive antenna where the voltage you're applying is a high number, therefore you're putting a huge amount of voltage higher than normal on the outside of the coax cable, you get a doubly bad situation. Higher insertion loss on the inside of the cable, a lot more voltage applying to the outside of the cable, you're probably going to have RF in the shack, and you're radiating some other crazy pattern with your transmission line as opposed to the antenna itself. You kind of lose in a hurry. And even if you put a balun there, let me drop. Even if you put a good coax balun, which makes the coax cable, the unbalanced cable, act like open wire line, that's the good news. The bad news is that balun is rated for a certain minimum frequency and is rated for a certain maximum standing wave ratio. If I buy a balun that's rated at the 100 watt level for 40 meters, and I use it at the 100 watt level at 80 meters, which puts it under a worst case condition, these balans tend to give you more trouble at lower frequencies, and I now make a 40 meter antenna being fed on 80 meters, where I'm using it at a lower frequency with much higher voltage, and I expect balancing action out of that thing, I'm probably going to take those little ferrite toroids that are inside that balun and burn them up. I'm using it beyond manufacturer's recommendation. You don't run into any of those problems when you use open wire line. Open wire line, though, is a little bit more troublesome to use. Suspending it, properly feeding it, having the right kind of a device that goes from your output of your coax cable from the transmitter and eventually end up properly feeding the open wire line. For some people, that's a little bit of a problem. Some of these automatic antenna tuners have the two terminals output meant to feed open wire line. So it pays your money, it takes your choice. You can use antennas out of their desired frequency range. As you can tell, you got to be careful. You got to know a little bit more about what you're doing in order to know where the pitfalls are that you could fall into. Now, Doug is a guy who has run a directional discontinuity ring radiator antenna in his backyard. Boy, he's got some interesting stories about that one. But that's another subject. W-A-2-S-A-Y, K-2-L-A-W in the tech net.
Dick, W-A-2-S-A-Y here. Well, I got a couple of comments. I tried
some years ago, I tried a fan dipole, a type of fan dipole anyway. What it was a rotor cable cut at, you know, where each of the wires was cut to, you know, a quarter wavelength at whatever frequency, you know, and then another piece like a dipole. It didn't get any kind of resonance effect at all. I think you really have to fan the wires out, like maybe a couple of feet on each side, maybe. I don't know, but that's what my experience is. The other thing is, if you could get the fan dipole to work, it seems to me you would have an extremely efficient harmonic radiator, and you would have a problem with harmonics. WA2SAY, back to that.
Just going to ask that question.
Okay, Joe. Hey, you're extremely right on both points there, Doug. First of all, rotor cable doesn't fan out anywhere near enough. All those leads are so close together in parallel, they're heavily coupled. On top of that, the kind of brown rubber that's used on rotor cable is really not a high-efficiency RF substance. You could if you wanted to spend enough time, because there's such close coupling between the 80, the 40, and the 20-meter dipole made out of rotor ribbon cable, you could drastically retune the 40 and the 20. The 80 is going to work pretty well. The 40 is going to see a lot of capacitive coupling to the 80-meter dipole. Therefore, it's going to have to be drastically shortened in order to re-hit resonance. And the same thing with the 20. You could retune it. You could force resonance. But because there's such tight coupling between them, it's a difficult alignment. The guy who wrote that article, I think it was an article in QSC Magazine, I don't think he went deep enough into those details. Or maybe he told you the exact dimensions that work for a particular brand of ribbon-type rotor cable. I think you're much better off really fanning them. But you're absolutely right. It's like a trap dipole or a fan dipole. Because the antenna itself will take each one of the frequencies coming out of your transmitter and properly radiate them by the right dipole. That's the good news. If your transmitter has got some harmonics, you're going to be radiating them like crazy. Now, because modern-day transmitters, by FCC edict, have all of the undesired harmonics something like 60 decibels down, I'd like to believe that that's not too serious a problem with modern-day well-built transmitters that have the right kind of output filters on them. And when in doubt, you and I could put a bandpass filter, a low-pass filter, or whatever to increase it. I know that that's Steve Polishin, who builds parallel kilowatt amplifiers. In order to be double darn sure that the second harmonic of his 432 parallel kilowatt amplifier didn't radiate 866 megacycles, 864 megacycles, he put an extra filter beyond the strip line resonator just to be sure that second and third harmonic is knocked down enough to even repeater. Time out. So there are solutions to that with the right kind of filtering. Any undesired frequency coming out of a transmitter, any undesired frequency getting into a receiver that's creating grief, if you're smart enough, you can put in the right kind of a band stop filter, the right kind of a band pass filter with enough shielding and enough filtering, you can live in almost any condition. Make believe you are the electronic engineer designing the communication network that goes on Air Force One. By definition, the president must have the ability to transmit on every one of his frequencies and receive on every one of his frequencies simultaneously to make sure that all the right information is getting to him. So with the right kind of filtering and proper spacing of the antennas on that single airplane, that airplane can, I'm going to exaggerate a little bit, almost cover DC to light with no transmitter interfering with no other receiver by an amount that is intolerable. With the right kind of shielding and filtering, that is possible. I didn't say it's easy, but you have the resources and you can do it. Who is it that just wanted to say some more words? Was it you, Rich, N2EO, K2RIW?
KC2QIQ with a comment.
Oh, it wasn't me, Dick.
Okay, was there another person other than Glenn? You got it, Glenn.
Yeah, this is just a small comment about measuring harmonics on the output of antennas or in the feed line to the antennas. And one of the things I've noticed was I had purchased, you know, early on a whole bunch of different filters, you know, everything from Draken line filters for HF, MFJ filters.